Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. This year, we've been doing an occasional series asking, what are solutions to the violence on urban streets? Today, we're going to spend an hour hearing about a concept called street mediation. It's where former gang leaders work to break the cycle of violence in Chicago. The program is based on the idea that violence runs through a city like an infectious disease, so if they can stop the cycle, they can decrease the murders and assaults. They use people called interrupters. They aren't actually trying to stop people from being in gangs. They're simply trying to end the violence that is paralyzing cities like Chicago, Oakland, Stockton, and Salinas. Amina Matthews is profiled in the film, and she says, on these streets, words can get you killed. Here's a scene from the documentary.
I need everybody from the ages of 13 to 24 to stand up. I'm the second oldest daughter to Jeff Ford, to ones that call Malik chief, and I'm fed up. Because each and every one of you all can be Duke right here. I'm gonna be real honest with you all because, see, we real talking up in here because Duke is real laying right in front of us. And it's the reason why this brother is here. I see these red caps. My brothers. I know we hurt because we love Duke. But we got a responsibility to bring up our community to be vibrant. Whatever it is that's going on, cease the fire, call a truce.
And that's Amina Matthews. She is one of the interrupters in the documentary called The Interrupters, and she's featured. She grew up in Chicago, where her father, Jeff Fort, was a major gang leader, and she was actually involved in gang activity herself for a number of years when she was younger. She's now one of the most respected and effective interrupters on the streets of Chicago, and she's joining us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago, along with Alex Kotlowitz, who with Steve James is the producer of The Interrupters, which won a DuPont Award and the Independent Spirit Award for Best Documentary. Alex, who's a longtime contributor to This American Life and the New York Times magazines, is the author of three books, including the national bestseller There Are No Children Here, which the New York Public Library chose as one of the 150 most important books of the 20th century. He's a writer in residence at Northwestern University, and he is also going to be joining us from WBEZ in Chicago. Amina and Alex, are you with us? So they are not with us yet. We're going to try and get them on the phone. We should probably be trying to get them on the phone, folks. The film is pretty amazing, and we've been talking about a different ceasefire model that was in Boston over the last couple of weeks. Now we're going to look at this Chicago model. But if you're somebody who's been involved in any of these violence prevention programs, we'd actually like to invite you to join our conversation at 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-8255. I'll give out that number and invite our audience to join this conversation in just a moment. But I think we might have Alex and Amina on the line now. Are you there with us?
We are, Holly. Hi, this is Alex.
Hi, and sorry about the little technical glitch. Amina, are you also with us?
I am. How are you?
Fine. So glad to have you both on and to have an hour to talk about this amazing program and the documentary. The audience just heard a clip, Amina, and it's when you were at the funeral of a young man and you got up to talk to people who were mourning, and it was a really moving speech where you say, we've got to end this. So the audience just heard that. I'm wondering if you could tell us, how did you end up getting involved with the ceasefire program? How did you become an interrupter, Amina?
I volunteered. One of the mothers called Teal Hardiman, the director of remediations, and said that her son was in their bedroom, loading a weapon to go back up to the school to defend his brother that was special needs. And a friend of mine called me that I've been known for well over 20 years and asked me to help in this conflict because did not know the young guy, but I probably knew the guys that were around in that area that can help me in. And I got in. And from that, working with that family, the young gentleman 2 years ago graduated. He got out of Chicago with the help of us. He graduated from Morehouse College because that was one of his dreams that he had, that he wanted to go to a historical black college. And he graduated with his criminal law degree. And he's still down there, and his mom's there, and his brother's down there. And the brother was diagnosed down there with autism, but he was in the eighth grade for really almost about 12 years, not having a diagnosed to an issue that was causing him to act and feel a certain way, and he didn't know what was going on. So when we got in, and we just really changed the mindset of that young, you know, the young brother as well as his family.
Well, maybe you can. I was wondering if you could actually explain to us how you changed the mindset. I mean, how does this program actually work? So kind of from the beginning, do you get a call about a shooting? How does it work?
Well, it's different areas. With ceasefire, there's major components. And one of the components is community mobilization, which means to and public education, which is to pass out public education about what we do as an organization and to get the young guys and the girls and their families to buy into the way that historically we've looked at how we defended ourselves for many years. If someone says someone at school hit me, 9 times out of 10 or 10 times out of 10, a mother, an aunt, a family member will say, hit them back. We felt like that was defending ourselves. But now guys that are, you know, winning or losing, and girls that are winning and losing fights, they're coming back with weapons of mass destruction and is really hurting a lot of people in the community. So if we get them to look at the behavior of violence, because violence is a learned behavior. It did not come with birth, you know, even though that parent, mother may go through a lot of traumatic things and subliminally, but violence in the way that we're seeing it now is a learned behavior. So, and just spending time and talking to guys and girls about life and how they feel about life and how they feel about themselves. And then we can deal with the conflict at hand afterwards, building relationships and getting them to understand that I'm just not here for a second. I will be here as long as you want me to be here.
And is that a commitment you can really make?
Oh, absolutely. That's a commitment that I love to have. I don't see it any other way. It's not effective if you don't have that type of commitment.
And let me bring Alex into this conversation. You've been writing about education and kids for years. What led you to help create this documentary? I know it was based on an article that you wrote.
Right. So, the film was done by myself and my partner on the film, Steve James. And I think both of us, because of previous work, were haunted by the violence and also perplexed by it. I mean, it's been so stubborn and so persistent in a place like Chicago. And we've also, Steve, from his film Hoop Dreams, from my first book, There Are No Children Here, have seen the incredible and profound impact it's had on families and friends. And so the film was really an effort to try to really understand the violence and also try to understand what we could do about it. And so we ended up spending 14 months with Amina and two of her colleagues, Kobe Williams and Eddie Bocanegra, and they were our guides to their communities. They were the ones who sort of helped us and ultimately audiences understand what was taking place.
And so what kind of insight did spending these 14 months with Amina and Eddie and Kobe, what do you think you learned?
Amina's giving me the evil eye here.
Why?
We learned, I think...
stalkers.
She
they were stalkers.
We did stalk. You know, it was pretty incredible. It was pretty inspiring to spend time with Amina. I mean, I think, you know, their job descriptions are pretty narrow. I mean, they're out there to mediate disputes. But what became clear to us, as Amina was just talking about, is they did so much more. I mean, they became mentors. They became kind of fill-in parents. They were able to get services for some of the people they were working with. And it made you realize, in some ways, in the end, I think more than anything, it's just what so many of these individuals were asking. And you see this in the film with some of the people that Amina and the others worked with, is they just were looking for somebody who would listen to them, who would hear their story, would kind of acknowledge their grievance. And in some ways, it seems so simple, and yet we haven't really figured it out.
Let me ask Amina about that stalker quote. Was it hard for you to do your work with all of these cameras following you around, Amina?
You know what? It was not all of these cameras. It was very, very... It was just one camera, and it was Zach Piper, and it was Alex and Steve and myself. I was the one carrying the boom, so I was the one holding the microphone. But to add, with the three of them and understanding, I didn't have a clue, to be really, really honest. And Alex can tell you, I didn't know what they wanted until maybe way past the filming had began. It took me a long time to commit to them as well. But
Amina was a really hard, it was like a really long courtship. I mean, Amina was really reticent to get involved, and she had all the right questions. You know, who were we to tell her story, the story of her community? And she just kept on peppering us with questions, and it took weeks, if not a couple of months, I think, to get Amina sort of comfortable with us. What did you say?
What convinced you?
A couple of minutes.
A couple of minutes. What convinced you finally then, Amina? What
convinced me is, going back to, first of all, they were very gentle in understanding what is going on in our community. And so it wasn't where it looks like Steve had the camera pretty much most of the time. Alex, you know, it looks like that they were very in our face with the camera or standing on top of their head trying to get a good shot, or it was not like that. They kept their distance and really understood boundaries. What convinced me was I talked to my support group, and I really didn't want my experience with cameras and stories being told from someone else's, from the standpoint of the media, such as the news, and you know, 8 times out of 10, it's not exactly what happened, and it portrays our community to be in a state of animalistic behavior where we're human beings. So what convinced me is that I remember Alex, I didn't know that he was the author of this book that has circulated throughout all of the penitentiaries.
Which one? There Are No Children Here? Uh-huh.
Yes. And his book, he talked about people that I personally knew, that I grew up with. And for two, in our community, people knew about the book. They didn't know the writer, the pen behind the book. But once I introduced Alex as being the writer of this book, and Steve being the person that the producer of Hoop Dreams, then that kind of eased a little bit of distrust on my part once I seen how my support system, which was the streets, reacted to three white boys. Alex wears police shoes. They look like police shoes. And I asked him over and over. He did go buy some new ones, and they look like the same ones that he had last time. But he really tried. But once I got the acceptance from my support group out in the street that they were cool, I kind of felt a little at ease that we can go forward, because their goal, Alex and Steve's goal, and Zach's goal, is to get us to tell our stories from beginning to end, not just my personal stories, but out in the community.
Well, so, and Alex, and Amina, let me, because so many people have not seen The Interrupters, I'd like to just give a little bit more of insight for people listening into what it is that you're documenting. And Amina, you mentioned the fact that, you know, some reporters or outsiders view behavior in some of America's neighborhoods is kind of irrational. And I think it was Tio who said in the film, the street is like Afghanistan, dying is honorable. And so I think a lot of people listening don't really understand what it's like to live in a neighborhood like the one that you're documenting in Chicago or in East Oakland or in Salinas. So I'm wondering if you both could try to help us get inside of how folks in the most dangerous neighborhoods in America think and feel, and explain some of the choices that they actually face.
Well, I think, you know, what's clear, you know, you spend time in a place like Englewood, where we spent a good deal of time with Amina, is that, you know, violence has really kind of shaped the landscape, the character of the landscape. And it's in many ways shaped and altered people's lives. And what you see, I think, you know, there's this kind of mistaken assumption that somehow people get hardened or accustomed to the violence. And I think it was pretty evident in those 14 months working on that film, the, you know, profound impact it has on the spirit of individuals. I mean, that was absolutely clear. I think the other thing that was clear to us, too, is that, you know, for the most part, the people we met, as much as they might have talked about their anger and about violence, that it's not something that people want to do. It's not a choice that people, under the best of circumstances, want to make. And so trying to sort of figure out a way, and this is what Amina was so terrific at, was sort of redirecting people's anger, redirecting their grievances in a way that wouldn't explode. I mean, there's this wonderful moment in the film where Amina talks about what she calls the 30 seconds of rage, where, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're wearing your cousin's sweater that's too small, you know, your stepfather's abused you, you haven't eaten the night before, and you get to school and somebody steps on your toe and you just go off on them. And it's got nothing to do with that moment. It has everything to do with all these pressures and forces that are bearing down on you. I mean, these are communities that are, you know, really struggling. And we saw that in the people that we spent time with.
And I mean, when you're dealing with that kind of rage and hopelessness, how do you talk somebody out of retaliating? What are the kinds of things that you say?
For one, I really do not believe that there is hopelessness in our community. I am so very understanding of this morning when I was taking my daughter to school, and just to look at the faces of the young girls and the young guys going into school and eager and happy to learn, even though that there's not a book inside of the school that they may be using, but they're still eager to go and want to learn. So when I'm dealing with young guys and girls that are living in poverty-stricken communities and a single-parent household, or the grandparent may be raising five or six grandchildren, and there is a circumstance or a situation that may end up in a conflict that I may have to mediate or stop by and check on, follow up. It's always giving them the education of what will happen if you take it to that next level of 30 seconds of rage, as well as what will happen if you don't and you continue to move forward and persevere through whatever struggles that you're having. You can get out and you can be the best. And life is just so very open to you and your ideas, and it's waiting for you. Life is waiting for you. So just to give them consequences on both ends, not that if you pull the trigger, this is the only thing that's going to happen, or if you, you know, go in and steal some food so your little sisters can eat and you get caught, this is what can happen. If you continue to get your education and you continue to stay in dream mode and you continue to read and educate yourselves about your city of Chicago, which this is a beautiful city, and there's guys and girls that I know that are 15 and 16 years old that we're at Navy Pier right now that can look from any part of their block in their community. They can look north and see the Willis Tower, which was called Sears Tower back in the day, that they can see it, but they've never been down here. You know, so if we open up the door of opportunity and let them walk through, just like with the young guy that I mentored before, I just opened the door for him, and he made the decision. I gave him 30 days. If you don't like it, you can come home. If you like it, we'll move your mom and your brother down. And he's been there, and he got expelled from the school systems, and he took a test down there at the college, dual enrollment, and now he's doing amazing. So it's just giving these guys opportunities to think. They have not had an opportunity to think. They've just had opportunities to react.
But I will say the thing that was amazing about watching Amina, because she's not going to toot her own horn, is that she was pretty fearless in the streets, still is. And she would do whatever it took. She'd go lecture people. She'd yell at people. She'd make them laugh. There's a moment early in the film where she's breaking up a fight, and a young guy who she's got in the backseat of her car, who Amina's gotten to walk away from the fight, which is not easy. You know, you really sort of begin to lose some pride. And so Amina's telling him, turns around and goes, you know, that was really gangster what you did. Telling him basically, you know, it's okay to walk away from a fight.
And you're sort of redefining the word gangster, right?
Yes, absolutely. Redefining and adding the real strength of what it is. You know, a gangster doesn't mean to pull the trigger and kill an innocent bystander or kill anybody. A gangster is that when you realize that right now it's not the time for me to have a conversation with you, let us calm down, cool off, come back to it, and maybe we can have some rational solutions. That's what Gangster is about.
And that's Amina Matthews. She is featured in the film The Interrupters, and she's one of the people who does these street interventions in Chicago, and that's what we're talking about today on Your Call. We're also joined by Alex Kotlowitz. He's the producer of The Interrupters, and he's also the author of the book There Are No Children Here. We'll invite your calls in just a moment. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. If you can't call to join the problem, you can always send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. The phone number in is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Programming on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new recordings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com. davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, how could bike sharing improve your city and maybe even your life? Starting in August, people can borrow and return bikes from different kiosks around town. Bike sharing is a popular program all around the globe, so how would it work in your area? And could cycle sharing help you get around? Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable. We'll speak with journalists about the week's news. Today, our conversation is about how we interrupt the cycle of violence on urban streets. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke with David Kennedy, author of Don't Shoot, about the ceasefire model of violence prevention. And today, we're speaking with Alex Kotlowitz, who produced the documentary film The Interrupters, and the film's protagonist, Amina Matthews, who is profiled in this film, showing her work interrupting violence in Chicago. And we're talking about how the ceasefire program works there, and asking the question, how much can be accomplished through direct violence interruption? And if you've ever been a part of an intervention like this, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And that's also where you can find more information about Chicago's ceasefires program and the book There Are No Children Here. And we actually want to hear from you about how you think we can stop the cycle of violence that is escalating in places like Oakland and Chicago. And if you've ever been involved in a gang, let us know about your experience and what you think of the term gang in particular. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. And if you work in schools, what do you think works in terms of reaching young people? Again, the number is 866-798-8255. Amina and Alex, I'd like to play a clip from the documentary The Interrupters now, and this is Eddie Bocanegra, who's one of the three interrupters that is featured in your film, and he does art classes with young people in Chicago schools. So let's go ahead and hear that.
Do you guys remember what we left off last week? We're working on our what?
Backgrounds,
right? It's about using a brush, crisscrosses, C's.
Last year, I had a hard time going to schools. You know, I was like, hey, look, I work for a violence prevention program, and a lot of them didn't want to acknowledge that there was issues in the schools.
I used a pencil to sketch it out, and I shaded it.
The Amnesty contacted the ceasefire. They were actually focusing at the school about violence and how they could help the community and so forth. And I was like, hey, what do you think about the idea of maybe introducing like art for them to express themselves about violence?
Now, this one right here, I kind of really like this one.
And when I was in prison, painting was my form of dealing with my issues and my problems and really discovering myself.
You got this angel, he's in hell. And then behind him is like some demons taunting him.
Art, it's kind of a way to hook the kids what they're thinking about.
What's the one thing in your neighborhood that you wish people could focus on more to help out?
Spray painting.
Spray painting. What about you?
The shootings.
The shootings?
Because my mom's scared that there's going to be a shooting going on me while I'm outside.
That is a clip from the documentary The Interrupters, which is the focus of our conversation today on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by Amina Matthews and Alex Kotlowitz. And I want to ask both of you, for me, that was one of the most painful things in watching this documentary and actually in, you know, talking with young people around the Bay Area, is this sense of how much violence is a part of the daily lives of these very young people, and almost a sense of this, these whole communities that have post-traumatic stress disorder without the post.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Eddie actually, you know, so Eddie's story is of that he, when he was 17, and was involved in a retaliatory killing of another gang member, and he's ended up serving 12 years in prison. And Eddie's actually thought a lot about this notion of PTSD because his brothers, both his brothers, served tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and one of them suffered greatly after the war. And when his brother was suffering, Eddie began to see some of what he was going through in his brother and began to realize the trauma that he had experienced. And so one of the things he's doing now is actually trying to get veterans, war veterans who have experienced PTSD, to come talk to gang members in his community, to get them to acknowledge and to grapple with some of the trauma that they've experienced. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing that happens in that scene that's not played is this young girl starts to cry when she talks about a shooting that had happened in her neighborhood not long ago.
Yeah, Amina, did you want to get in on that whole question of the post-traumatic PTSD?
Well, it's real, and that's something that needs to be that's a conversation that needs to be addressed, because we're dealing with young guys and girls that are going to school and they're in the seventh grade, and because of post-traumatic stress, it limits them to even open their mind to read or write or to focus. And so we're looking at seventh graders that are maybe at the second grade level because of the, it's not even misdiagnosed, it's undiagnosed, mm-hmm. that they need to have in the school systems, because it's very hard to be an educator as well as part mom, part social worker, as being in that classroom and a referee. So when we're looking at that from the school level, the institution of schools, we have to get the superintendent and the teachers to, we have to get the teachers to tell the stories of what is going on with our young youth in schools that 10 times out of 10 escalate and hit the streets and ends up in a shooting that would have not just two students. Now those students have family members. And that from that, the violence is transmitted from one family to another. And then that's why when you're listening to the news and you're listening to the media from the newspaper standpoint, that it was a gang-related type of altercation, when it really was something that happened from school, from a learning disability, and then it was taken to the next level where violence was exhibit. So it's a multifaceted of things of why we see the violence that's plaguing our nation, not just Chicago, but our nation in a awful way, in a number of you know, when we look at Chicago and people can say, well, Chicago has always been historically a volatile city. It's been a mafia-based driven city. What is so paralyzing to me, Holly, and the callers, is that the perpetrators and the victims are very, very young. We're looking at, I just visit a juvenile detention center, and I looked at a 13-year-old. My daughter just turned 12 yesterday. And I'm looking at a 13-year-old that's facing double life. At 13, you haven't expressed the love of your mother in a full capacity. You haven't expressed the love for yourself in a full capacity. You don't even know who yourself would be possibly. At 13, you don't have a clue, but you're facing a double murder. And the reason why it ended up in that way is because he was 13 and he was about 4'11", and everyone would tease him and call him Shorty. And he just couldn't, from his standpoint, couldn't take it anymore. So we have to talk about issues that's going on in the school systems. And Eddie's absolutely right. When we're looking at it's school systems is one of the hardest places that we can get into, because the principal does not want others to see. That's just like me coming to your house and you may have your underwear over the shower curtain, and I come unexpectedly, and you're trying to reach it and take it down and tuck it and cover it. They don't want the issues as will be perceived to them as dirty laundry or their business, in-house business, to be brought to attention. To us, it is that we want it to be brought to a solution. So we're not judging. We're not looking to tell or mandate reporters of what's going on. We're here to help so it won't be another homicide.
And you're listening to Your Call. We're speaking with Amina Matthews and Alex Kotlowitz. Alex is one of the producers of the documentary, The Interrupters, which features the work that Amina Matthews does on the streets of Chicago to try and interrupt the cycle of violence with intervention. And let's go ahead and get a caller on to the show. Hi, Mickey. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
So my question for Alex and Amina is, they have said that they're dealing with the issues that I feel like a lot of times in the standard media get pointed, blamed on violent video games and like gangster rap music. And I was wondering what they thought about the relationship between culture like that and the actual violence itself, and if that's like an accurate connection or if there is any kind of relationship.
You know, I'm going to take a kind of contrarian view on all this. You know, culture in the end is really reflective, I think, of what's going on in people's lives. And so I think so much of rap and certainly video games are reflective of that. I actually think in some ways the video games and the violent movies, and I'll hold off on the rap for a moment, are kind of a release for kids who experience this violence in a very real way. I mean, my kid is 15. He plays video games. I'm not worried about him becoming violent in any way. I think with the rap music, I think, you know, it's a two-way street. I think on the one hand, much of it reflects what's going on the streets. I think there's also can be a glorification of the violence. And I certainly personally take issue with some of rap and hip-hop. But you know, there's a really robust conversation now going on in that community. Amina is, again, I'm getting the evil eye again, Holly.
This let's hear from Amina. Thanks for alerting me to the evil eye when it happens, Alex.
That's not true. I'm just listening to Alex Kotlowitz talk about hip-hop. I'm very, you know, it's just, to me, Holly, it's just such a needed view from Alex's point of view, and as well as from my point of view, as well as the young guys and girls are living the life that they're living. What I do challenge, is it Mickey, the caller?
Yeah.
What I do challenge is our young brothers and sisters that have the platform to make the music, far as the hip hop, rap, or and that to me, for me, music saved my life, Holly. Music saved my life. Phil Collins, James Taylor, Fleetwood Mac, Mary J., Lauryn Hill, Nia Simone saved my life. And it was not just only Stevie Wonder. It was not just only the percussions and the deep sounding of the music. It was the words that was beating with the music. So I challenge my brothers and sisters that have the platform that needs to, do we need an outlet? Absolutely. Me and as adult need an outlet of feelings and emotions. And our young youth that are dealing with a lot of things that's going on in their lives, they need an outlet. However, they need a way to express it in a healthy way that they can still articulate themselves, that they have fear of abandonment issues, that they have insecure issues with whatever may be going on with them. If it's that they're not sure on who they are sexually, or who they are physically, or their body image, or, you know, how they look with their glasses on, or how they sound when they talk, or if they don't know how to read at an age that grade appropriate, if they're in the seventh grade and they're reading at a second grade level, they need to have a way, an educational platform on how to articulate themselves. And what I'm seeing now, because I was raised on NWA and, you know, Public Enemy, far as when we talk about the hip hop culture, that's, you know, that's, those were the people that I was raised around to listen. And it was about the revolution, about us sticking together as people of color and us not being fools and not being, you know, hoodwinked or slipped the okie doke by, you know, the political issues that may be going on in our community to cause boarded up buildings that we see now, poor education that we're seeing now, poor food that we're eating now. So what I challenge our hip hop brothers and sisters that have that opportunity, the Kanyes, the Commons, the Jay-Z's, the Keisha Cole's, the Beyonce's, the girls that they're looking and the guys that they're looking up to, I challenge them to come into the communities and say, look, this is how you articulate yourselves to get A. Because now they're looking at young guys that came from the block, that got a $5 million record deal, that is talking about nothing but destroying himself and his community. So I think the hip hop culture plays a great part of why things are the way that they are. I do too, Alex, have a son and he has an Xbox game, and I really don't think that I have to worry about him. However, Holly, I talk about that 30 seconds of rage. Mm-hmm. I remember listening to Prince Henry, that's the youngest one, right? And he serves over in the military over there. And he said to the whole in an interview that he would not have learned how to shoot accurately if he did not play that PlayStation or Xbox. So when I'm looking at my son that's 14 and possibly an issue may come up in his life that he remembers the game, and we talk about, and that's what's so important. We talk about the games that he's interested in playing with. And that's why it's important for the education needs to be passed down to our generation about the games that you play. Those are games. And you need to know the reality between, you know, the reality of games and the reality of life.
And that's Amina Matthews. She's joining your call along with Alex Kotlowitz, and they're talking about the documentary The Interrupters and the ceasefire program in Chicago. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. It's 866-798-8255. And if you are a young person or you're somebody who works with young people and you see these cycles of violence and these neighborhoods that are full of poverty and are very dangerous for young people, tell us what you think works in terms of solving the root problems of this epidemic of violence in places like Salinas and Oakland. 866-798-8255. Again, it's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And Alex, so we're talking a lot about young people and kind of what the reality of the life they face is, and kind of how a lot of older men are talking about that the violence on the streets, the level of violence has really changed. And you recently reported a series for This American Life where you spent a semester at Harper High School in Chicago. And there's a scene in that documentary where kids talk about the need to carry a gun for protection, that it isn't just so-called gang members. Everybody in the community is feeling unsafe. And somebody says in it, you know, whether or not you want to be in a gang, you are in one based on where you live. So can you just talk to us a little bit about what you discovered about what life is like for young people while you were reporting the Harper High series?
Sure. I mean, yeah, we spent the semester at Harper High School, this amazing place, which is remarkable staff. It, we're, as you say, was reeling from this terrible, terrible year where they had eight current and former students killed and another 21 shot and wounded. And, you know, it was interesting. I mean, the gang structure has changed so dramatically over the past 20 years from when I did There Are No Children Here. Back then, it was very hierarchical, very top-down. It was all revolved around the drug trade, and that's changed dramatically, in large part because so many of the gang leaders have been put away in prison. And so what we found when we were at Harper is that, you know, you went from block to block and you had, they don't even really call themselves gangs anymore. They call themselves cliques or crews, and they tend to be just groups of friends on one block and then groups of friends on another block. They're fighting often things that they can't even, don't, not even sure what they're about. I think I want to say around Harper there were somewhere around 15 to 20 different cliques within that neighborhood that the school had to keep track of. And wherever you lived, that was who you were basically affiliated with. There was whether you wanted to or not. And so what the kids talked about at Harper was just whether they had agreed to become part of a gang or not because of where they lived, they were associated with a particular clique or crew. And I think what happens, and you alluded to this, is that people look for to guns because there's kind of an arms race that goes on. The people get them for protection, and when somebody gets it for protection, somebody else gets it for protection, and it goes on and on and on. I think, you know, it's pretty, you look at the numbers. I mean, last year in Chicago, they took 13,000 guns off the street. I mean, it's just a phenomenal number, and it's a number that's pretty steady over the years. Go ahead.
I wanted to see. So you're talking about the availability of guns, but I wanted to get to I want to get to another caller in just a second here. But I wanted to get to some of the criticisms of ceasefire, and one of them is that the murder rate has gone up in Chicago over the last 2 years, and so people are saying, well, ceasefire doesn't work. The other criticism is the reliance on ex-cons is a serious problem for law enforcement. So could you two address that briefly so that we can get to at least one more caller?
Right. Well, I'll take the second one, and I'll let Amita deal with the first. So on the hiring of ex-felons, it's really at the heart of what ceasefire does. And in fact, it's because of their resumes, it's what allows them to go out and mediate disputes. They are able to go out there because they've got some respect. And these are individuals who, for whatever reason, and for me, it's one of the things that was inspiring spending time with Amina, Eddie, and Kobe, the three protagonists in the film, is that there are second acts in life, and they're testament to that. You know, for a country that I think likes to think of itself as forgiving, we can often, I think, sometimes be terribly unforgiving. And I think the fact that they use people who've been on the streets or for whatever reason have turned their life around is what allows them to go do what they do. But Amina, do you want to talk to that first question about
whether or not ceasefire is a failure because it has not decreased the murder rate in Chicago?
Last year, we were involved in over 470 plus conflicts, and may have been on the front end as well as the back end to stop a retaliation. And to add to that is the area of Inglewood, Woodlawn, Roseland, Humble Park, the areas that we're getting funded for, Holly, they have about 15 to 18 beats. So, and when I say beats, I mean like the police beats. Mm-hmm. So it's from 10 blocks north to maybe 15 blocks east. So that's one beat. And out of those 15 beats, in Inglewood in particular, we are only funded for 3 of those beats.
So it's not fair to expect you guys to solve the entire problem.
But, and, however, when you look at the relationship that we just started with the city, when Brother Rahm Emanuel, our mayor, looked at our model and say, hey, we're going to give you guys an opportunity to get this down for, and we work together because it's going to take la-di-da-di everybody to do, law enforcement. It's going to take the faith-based leaders. It's going to take the mom and dads. It's going to take the uncles. It's going to take the grassroots organizations and even just the community outside of the have-not community to come together to come to a solution. We were funded by the city for Woodlawn and for Lawndale in September, the end of August, the beginning of September. Woodlawn, there would be a homicide, 2 to 3 homicides a night. So we were looking at the reduction of Woodlawn, which is the beat that I'm working in, where we heard about the young six-month-old that had got killed the earlier part of last week. From August, from September up until the day that that young baby lost her life, we have brought down the shootings and the homicides, the reduction 87%. And that's only in 3 beats in Woodlawn, from a 18 to 20 beat community.
So you're saying it is working, and I'm so sorry that we're going to have to leave it here, but we are just completely out of time. Thank you both for joining us. Amina Matthews is featured in the film The Interrupters. She's one of the people who does these street interventions in Chicago. Alex Kotlowitz is producer of The Interrupters, and he's the author of There Are No Children Here. We'll put a link to all of that information and more at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments there. I so apologize that we couldn't get to our callers. We really wanted to feature you. We just ran out of time. You can continue to post information and continue this discussion at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How could bike sharing improve your city? This August, commuters in San Francisco, San Jose, and other cities along the Caltrain line will be able to borrow and return bicycles at kiosks in different locations. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District will implement this $7 million pilot program. Bike sharing is popular in other cities across the country and around the globe. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Would cycle sharing help you get around? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.